Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio, of course, hosted by Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called Watching the Detectives, Investigative Journalism and Forensic Science, with very special guest, Douglas Starr. So now, without any further ado, here are your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome, everyone. I'm really excited to have our guest today as Doug Starr. Douglas Starr is the co-director of the Graduate Program in Science and Medical Journalism at Boston University. He's also the author of one of the best nonfiction books I've read in the field of forensic science. It's really a beautifully written, intriguing story, The Killer of Little Shepherds. It's a true crime story and the birth of forensic science. He's also the author of Blood, An Epic History of Medicine and Commerce. And he's written about science and medicine and public health and the environment in just about anything you've read. You've probably read his work. The New Yorker, Slate, Science, Smithsonian, National Public Radio, Los Angeles Times, Sports Illustrated, Christian Science Monitor, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. So welcome to our program, Douglas Starr.
It's nice to be here. Thanks, Jan.
Yeah, Doug, it's great to have another Doug on the show.
we'll keep it straight.
We'll try to keep it all straight.
Yeah.
Why don't you give us a little bit about your background and how you wandered your way into this specialized area of journalism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was one of those kids who grew up reading National Geographic and saying, I want to be one of those guys. So I was always doing literature and science. In college, I did the equivalent of a double major in foreign languages and zoology. Started traveling the world when I was 20, learned a few languages, started a career as a marine biologist, but always had this thing for writing and sort of started leaning towards science writing through newspapers, magazines, and then eventually to the university where I am. So it's kind of the... It's funny, you know, I admit graduate students every year, and it's the same thing. They look at me as if to say, have I finally found a home where I could do both of these things? And that's how I ended up here.
Well, we do this show in part because we want the public to better understand forensic science. What do you see as the major challenges in raising public awareness of forensic science? And here we're speaking of real forensic science, not imagined forensic science.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really good question, and we could do the whole show on this question because it's pretty important. I mean, obviously, there's the first thing of what you see on TV has pretty much nothing to do with what takes place in the real world. And I guess your listeners are aware of that already. You know, forensic scientists do not go to crime scenes with guns. The same people who do the laboratory analysis do not show up on the crime scene. You don't do a DNA analysis in the course of an hour. It takes weeks, and sometimes the lab is backed up for months. So there's the reality versus fiction thing. But then within reality, we're actually in a very difficult time right now where, in a sense, because of the scientific basis of DNA, which is real science, it's kind of shown that a lot of the traditional forensic sciences are more tradition than science. To give you a couple of examples, bite mark analysis, that's now pretty much been thrown out as non-science, but quite a few people have been convicted of crimes based on bite mark analysis. Arson detection, a lot of the things that people traditionally thought were clear indications of arson happen all the time in accidental fires, and this is only something learned in the last decade because scientists actually did experiments in laboratories, huge laboratories the size of airplane hangars, burned houses down and measured it and found out these signs of, quote, arson happen all the time. So I think the biggest challenge for forensic science right now is sorting out what's real science versus what's kind of common wisdom that's turning out not to be science at all.
What Jan mentioned earlier, your book, The Killer of Little Shepherds.
Yeah.
And obviously it's about a pioneer in this industry, Alexander Lacassagne. And I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about him and what his story
was.
Yeah.
Now, first of all, I've got to congratulate you on pronouncing his name perfectly.
It only took me 6 years.
It always comes out as lasagna or something.
Lasagna. It looks like lasagna, doesn't it?
It was really fun to come upon him. He was kind of one of the grandfathers of forensic science as we know it. He lived in the latter half of the 19th century in France. And he was a physician, but one of the first specialists in forensic science. And he was kind of the moral leader of a whole cadre of scientists who took the new tools of science and started applying them to crime scene analysis. As it turns out, this took place pretty much entirely in Europe. The U.S. at the time was a few decades behind Europe. The real leaders at the time were France, Austria, Italy, and Germany. And these were scientists who knew anatomy, chemistry, physiology, to a degree physics, and they started thinking, what can we do with science to understand what goes on at a crime scene? And Lacassagne was sort of the chief honcho. He started a journal called the Archives of Criminal Anthropology that existed for 30 years, and that became the preeminent scientific journal of crime scene analysis. So he was the man. And one of the things that was exciting to me was he was pretty much lost to history, and I felt that I got to rescue him from historic obscurity.
Well, you know that the people, I always tell people, the way forensic science actually came about is, first of all, you know, something cool was discovered by somebody, and it was more or less basic science, and then it usually entered somewhere in the medical world and got applied to medicine at whatever state it was in. And then the scientists who dealt with the people who dealt with law enforcement then started taking some of that stuff and dragging it into the criminal investigation scene. Mm-hmm. What was the state of forensic science at the time Lacassagne walked around?
It was pretty raggedy. It wasn't awful. I mean, there was toxicology. People were doing chemical analysis of bodies. But there was a lot of superstition. So people felt that after a while, if a body was in the presence of the murderer, it would start bleeding again. And that, of course, had to do with the putrefaction of the bacteria. They really didn't know what they were doing. So the forensic period of the 1880s and 90s was really a revolution. And we could look at some of the things that they figured out. So first of all, it was systematic autopsies. I mean, people did autopsies, but they were ridiculous. Lacassagne and his colleagues actually came up with these things called observation sheets, in which they were actually like flow charts on what you fill out when you're doing an autopsy. They came up with an order so that when you did an autopsy, you didn't totally mangle the body, but you actually came up with something. They designed these, what they called criminal museums, in which they would display, preserved bodies and the weapons that caused the wounds so people could begin to understand what certain kinds of wounds look like. They discovered lividity. Lividity is the phenomenon that after somebody dies, the blood tends to settle downward because the heart is no longer beating. And if the dead body is laying on the ground for a while, there are these purple splotches on the bottom. And if you later turn the body, those splotches stay at the same part of the body, which tells you that the body had been turned. This is a very important clue. They understood which populations of bacteria and blowflies will populate a cadaver, which gave them hints as to how long somebody had been dead. They did things like very carefully measure bone lengths of hundreds and hundreds of cadavers to begin to understand that a certain length of a shin bone, for example, would indicate a person of a certain height. They looked at tooth patterns. So really, the things they did were extraordinary when you consider the body of work. It was really the real foundation of forensic science.
The Killer of Little Shepherds also gives us a look at the state of the field of criminal psychology at the time. And I was wondering if you could tell us about the title character, Joseph Fauché and his encounters with the mental health system of his day. I found that part of the book fascinating as
it
well.
It was amazing. And I should say, in doing the research, you know, I traveled back and forth to France quite a bit, and this is all based on the original records. So I was able to find the courthouse where the trial took place, and they still had crates and crates of handwritten testimony about the case. I went to the insane asylum where he was, and I found his records, and I found his admission records, handwritten. But,
wow.
Yeah, it was that gave me a chill. The surprising thing was the insane asylum was beautiful, because this was the era where people had just figured out that the way to treat troubled people was humanely and not brutally. So instead of shackling them to the wall, they would give them a nice place to stay. They would talk to them. If they were getting riled up, they would give them warm baths. I mean, it was the real beginning of modern mental health care and compassionate care. But in terms of Vacher's state of mind, he was most certainly a psychopath, although the term wasn't known at the time. But I have records dating back to his boyhood and birth. And from the get-go, he did crazy, cruel things. The standard behavioral symptoms of a psychopath, he tortured animals, anything that was in his way. He had no compunction against killing. He lacked empathy. If he wanted something, he took it. And he was pretty much that way all through life. His first serious encounter with the mental health system was in 1893, when he was stalking a young woman and became obsessed with her, and when she rejected him, he shot her a few times. The bullet didn't kill her. And then he turned the gun on himself. Nobody got killed. They were all wounded, and he was then taken to a couple of different asylums, both in the countryside in France. And he went to one, and then he went to the second one, which was in near Grenoble. It was a lovely place. And they thought he had delusions and monomania, and he was ranting. But because of the gentle treatment, he rapidly calmed down, and after 3 months, they turned him loose. Which, as one newspaper later reported, that was like opening the door to the cage of a wild beast. About 5 weeks after he was turned loose, he had some sort of relapse, and his killing spree began.
Doesn't it seem like it always happens?
You got me.
I
think we do a lot better nowadays.
Yeah, we do.
You know, they just were looking at symptoms, and it was a very early understanding of psychopathy, and they thought he calmed down, so he was fine. Off he went.
And what else? Yeah, they wouldn't have known better.
Well, yeah.
You mentioned a lot of the stuff that Lacassagne did, and I know that, you know, in most science, those who work in the field are standing on the shoulders of those who came before, and that's kind of how science works. What things were most important that he did, that he discovered, that progressed forensic science forward into the next century? Or was it more his methods, his method of doing things, or was it the actual stuff he put together, or was it both?
It's both, and it's also difficult to completely separate Lacassagne from his colleagues. I mean, there were things that I could document he actually did by himself. For example, looking at the marking patterns on a bullet. He did that. You know, everything we see in, you know, matching a bullet to a gun, he did that. There was a case of somebody got shot, and he was doing the autopsy, and he was struck by the fact that the bullets that hit bone had the same markings that the bullets that didn't hit bone. And he was a very curious guy, and he said, "Get me that gun." And these were different times, so he worked near a hospital, and he was able to get some bodies out of the hospital, which is difficult to do today, and he started shooting them. They were dead already. And very carefully documented it, and he noticed this pattern, and in time, he was able to figure out that what was making the markings on the bullet wasn't the bone or the lack of bone, but the striations in the barrel of the gun. And then he systematically started doing that with a lot of guns, so he pretty much invented the field of ballistics testing. He was the one who figured out lividity. He and his colleagues figured out putrefaction. His nephew figured out the business that certain bone lengths indicate a certain height of a person. His nephew needed a thesis, and Lacassagne said, "Well, I've always wondered about that. Why don't you do that?" And it ended up solving a lot of important cases. It was another colleague who figured out which populations of insects colonize a body. So it's, you know, other than fingerprints and DNA, it's hard to find an area of forensics that this guy didn't influence in the very beginning.
Mm. Well, just as Lacassagne challenged assumptions in forensic science, that's an ongoing process, of course, in forensic science. So one of the ways in which I think changes are brought about is through science journalism. So can you talk about the role science journalism plays in that process?
Yes. Of course, in those days, the journalism was a little bit crazy. You know, they had the tabloids and these crazy pictures of the murderers, and really, it was quite hysterical, not in the funny way, but in the overwrought way. Nowadays, science journalism, like any kind of journalism, can act as a way of holding up an intelligent mirror to the process. You know, we've been reading a lot about the Innocence Projects and false convictions, and in terms of what we're discussing, a surprising number or a distressing number of false convictions arise from bad science. And to that degree, a journalist who's got a background in science, who's writing about this and knows the scientific method, I think is more apt to take a penetrating look at what's going on than somebody who's just winging it. So to our mind, you know, having the scientific background, and all of the students in my program either have science degrees, have been scientists, or took a ton of science, having that background lets you evaluate what's going on a bit more intelligently and ask the kind of questions that need to be asked.
Well, speaking of the questions that need to be asked,
yeah,
that's a good segue into an article of yours appeared in The New Yorker about police interrogation. So let's talk about the interview. And to start off with, maybe as to give the backdrop to this, tell us what the Reed method is.
Yes. Now, I should say, especially with what's going on nowadays, the kind of police interrogation we're talking about is not the Guantanamo stuff. This is your average nice guy policeman who's really trying to do a good job. Okay, I want to establish that. Most police in America either get no formal training with interrogation, which is horrifying, or the standard method they're taught is something called the Reed technique. The Reed technique was developed by a man in Chicago named John Reed, former policeman, who was a polygraph expert. And in doing polygraphs, he started noticing conditions under which people became nervous or not nervous and what their body language was. And he devised a technique with a colleague named Fred Inbau that uses the kind of questions a polygrapher might ask to see if a person gets nervous. And then if they get nervous, you sort of determine if they're lying. And then if you think they're lying, you leave the room, you come back in, and the rest of the technique is a very forceful interrogation in which you do most of the talking and you don't take no for an answer until they confess. Now, in no time does somebody doing the Reed technique touch the other person, hit them, threaten them. It's not like on TV. The interviews you see on TV are far more brutal than would be permitted, but the technique is deeply coercive, and it leads to a certain number of a kind of collateral damage and false confessions. And I investigated this for many months, and 35 years of science has shown that this is a bad technique, very dangerous, and some other countries have abandoned it in favor of other techniques, but it's basically based on 1950s era psychology that has been scientifically shown to be incorrect, and although it causes true confessions, also causes false ones. And I should add, confessions are so powerful. You know, people just can't imagine that anybody would confess to a crime he didn't commit, but it happens readily. They are so powerful that they bend all the other evidence, even fingerprints. Even fingerprints. People have done scientific studies and found that fingerprint examiners, when told that somebody confessed to a crime, subconsciously come up with the finding of a match. So So it's a very dangerous thing to be using, and we've got well-intentioned police officers waving this thing around as though they know what they're doing, and they don't.
So this procedure, this method has been tested scientifically. What kind of results popped up out of that? I mean, how often were it false positive, or did they even know that? Did they do scientific studies and gather data on the usefulness and the fallacy of the Reed method?
As I said, there's been 35 years of scientific research. Nobody's been able to quantify
right.
how false confessions take place. Actually, nobody knows in America how many false confessions take place. The Innocence Project, which has now freed, I guess, almost 320 people, and it's DNA, so it's definitive. About a quarter of those went to jail on false confessions. They just felt pressured into confessing, and some were death penalty. What the scientific research has shown in the lab is that you could really get a false confession by using these techniques. And they do fascinating experiments that I could go into in a few minutes that really tease it out. They also do field studies. There was a famous field study in England called Who Killed My Relative? And the psychologist got several videos of people who had gone on television pleading with alleged kidnappers to return their son or daughter. These were real things. And he took cases that later turned out that the person who made the plea actually was the murderer, as it later turned out. So he then showed these videos to police who were unfamiliar with it to see who figured out whether these people were lying about or not. And the police hit it about 50-50, which is the average person's chance of detecting a lie. Most of us have coin-flipping odds of guessing if somebody else is lying. So that's not a very good average. There was another fascinating study by an American psychologist. He went to a place where he could find some very good liars. He went to a prison in northern Massachusetts, and he recruited several prisoners, I think about a dozen. Half of them confessed on video to their crimes. Half of them confessed on video to their buddies' crimes, meaning half were lying. He showed these videos to a group of police and to a group of students. The police were slightly less often correct than the students were. Kind of random. But what was scary was the police were dead certain that they were right. So what this means is you had a body of people who had a 50-50 chance of getting it right, but they were positive they were right, which means if you're being interrogated by a policeman and he thinks you're the guy or you're the woman, your chance of walking out of there are not very good. And I actually met the president of the Reed Company. It's still a company now. It has a virtual monopoly on training. Very nice man. But I said to him, what if you have the wrong impression of my guilt, and you're interrogating me, and you're bearing down on me until you get a confession? I said, what can I do? He says, get up and walk out. I said, how many people do you know who have the fortitude when police are interrogating to just say, you know what, I'm out of here? I said, that's not going to happen. He said, well, that's what you got to do.
Well, once again, we want to remind our listener that this phrase, am I free to go?
Yeah. is important.
Is important. You have rights.
So, a couple of things I want to emphasize. Number one is nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I want to get a false confession. They're not trained properly. And I met police who saw that they had accidentally contaminated interrogation when it was videotaped and were alarmed. The thing that really struck me was the volume of email I got after this article came out. And I expected to get critical email because people don't like being critical. I can't tell you how many police officers throughout the country, including one counterintelligence officer who couldn't give his name, said, thank goodness you wrote this article. This has been bothering me for years. I knew something was wrong with this. So they want to do it right.
Well, it sounds like we're coming up on our break, so this is a good point to just tell our listeners to hang in there. We'll be right back with more great discussion with Douglas Starr.
Take your manuscript to the next level with Yeah Sure Editorial Services. Writing, editing, proofreading, and more. Visit www.yeahshoreeditorial.com. Publisher Midnight Inc. brings fans the very best mystery books. Resurrection Bay by Wayne McDaniel and Steve Womack. Terminated by Ray Daniel. Trapline by Mark Stevens are just a few of the great books available now. Check out www.midnightinkbooks.com for more information on this and many more titles. Waters of Oblivion is the third book in David Lyon's Jock Boucher thriller series. The series started with Ice Fire and then Blood Game. Check out davidlyonsauthor.com for more information on all the books in the series. Two mothers, two sons, a trail is going cold. The Missing Place is the latest book from author Sophie Littlefield. A satisfying, icy thriller is what Kirkus Review says. Check out simonandschuster.com for more information on this and all of their great books. If your family is a target, you have to be a weapon. Bloodline by John Davis is a high-octane thrill ride. And the latest in the Granger Spy novel series. When you can't trust anyone else, trust your family. Visit johnjdavis.com for more information. Suspense Magazine is giving readers the deal of a lifetime, and we do mean lifetime, because right now, anybody that orders a subscription to Suspense Magazine will get that subscription automatically flipped into a lifetime one. That means only $24 will ensure that you receive Suspense Magazine forever. So go to suspensemagazine.com and click on Order the Magazine and get your lifetime subscription today.
Join Stephen King, Peter Straub, Ellen Datlow, Ramsey Campbell, Jonathan Mayberry, and hundreds more in the Horror Writers Association's campaign, HorrorSelfies.com. Take a selfie with any written message promoting reading or with your favorite book. Check in at HorrorSelfies.com to submit your photo, and you can win signed books. Help us let the world know why horror is important and submit your selfie today. That's www.horrorselfies.com.
All it takes is the perfect shot. You can take your shot this year in New York City during the 10-year anniversary of Thriller Fest. Take aim during Craft Fest, Pitch Fest, Thriller Fest, and new this year, Career Fest, all designed to help you hit your mark. Meet the pros, like 2015 Thriller Master Nelson DeMille, Silver Bullet recipient Kathy Reichs, with spotlight guests Greg Isles, Charlene Harris, and Mark Billingham. And let the best help you zero in on your career target at the Grand Hyatt in New York City, July 7th through the 11th, 2015. It's time. Take your shot. Register now. www.thrillerfest.com.
Radio. Again, today's show is called Watching the Detectives, Investigative Journalism and Forensic Science with special guest Douglas Starr. So now let's come back here to your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome back, everyone. We were talking before the break about the Reed method of interrogation, which, as we were saying, it's people of goodwill using it, but it's got some problems. So maybe we could start off this half of the show talking about sort of specifically in terms of getting into some of the mechanics of it. What are some of the basic problems with that method?
Okay, that's a good question. There are a few. So the basic assumption that they make is that lying goes hand in hand with anxiety, and it doesn't. People are anxious for all sorts of reasons. If somebody is accused of killing his wife and he didn't do it, he's going to be very anxious. So that's number one. Number two is that body language is associated with deception. It's not. 35 years of science has shown body language is associated with all sorts of things, associated with anxiety, with status, with self-worth, with all sorts. It has nothing to do with deception. If I look to the side when I'm talking to you, it doesn't mean I'm lying. It could mean I'm trying to think. If I cross my arms, it doesn't mean I'm trying to pretend I'm not telling the truth. It just means I'm crossing my arms. So these were things that were scientifically established. So what the Reed technique does is, in the first part of the interview, they have what they call a behavioral assessment interview, kind of like with a polygraph. They ask you all sorts of questions and watch you. They'll also ask you a question called the bait question, which might be, what do you think they should do to the guy who did this? Or they might say, if we found your DNA at the... No, they might say, we're looking at DNA. Is there a chance we're going to find your DNA at the site? And if you seem nervous, and if they decide you're lying, as I mentioned, they leave the room and then they come back, and then the person will have a file containing nothing in particular. Say, Ms. Burke, our investigation has conclusively showed that you did indeed cause the death of that child. And now let's just talk this through and just get beyond this. And when you try to deny it, we're now in what's called the interrogation phase. I won't hear anything of it. And you'll say it. I'll say, Ms. Burke, please, we've been through this. If you try to ask to see what's in the file, say, Ms. Burke, we could get to this later. I'm trying to help you here. Let's just find out what happened. Let's get to the bottom of it. What happens, as time goes by, I'm showing maximum certainty that you did it, and I'm not leaving any room for error, and this is going to get you crazy. And it's called maximization. And you're just beginning to see there's just no way out. Then I do something called minimization, in which I minimize the moral condemnation. So I might say, you know, Ms. Burke, if I had a kid like that, who knows what I would have done. Kids drive me crazy. My own kid, you know, I swear to God, but the phone rang just when I was going to do something crazy, and I didn't, and therefore the grace of God go I, maybe I would have done what you did. In other words, I keep lowering the moral bar so that you realize I don't think you're such a bad person. And you will be tempted to confess if you realize, look, I'm just not getting out of the room. He understands. The other interesting factor is studies have shown that naive people with a good, solid faith in the American justice system are more likely to confess, because you're going to think, you know what, this guy is impossible. I'm not getting out of here. I'm exhausted. I'll confess and the justice system will clear me. I have faith. But that never happens. Because what happens is, once there's a confession, it trumps everything. And as I mentioned in the last segment, even fingerprints bend. And it's not that people say, you confess, so forget about it, but it's like, if she confessed, maybe I wasn't with her Tuesday night. If she confessed, yeah, those blood tests are looking bad. It's a subconscious thing. So this is a very dangerous situation, and the whole setup of the thing is inappropriate. In a minute, we'll get into other ways of doing it. I may not have mentioned that I myself, as part of this article, became trained as a police interrogator. So not only from studying the technique and from spending months and months interviewing the scientists who examined it, but I also became trained because people had told me, you know, what they tell you as a reporter and what you see in the session is going to be a little bit different. And it's true. You know, when I interviewed Mr. Buckley, the president of the company, he said, oh, we don't go for a confession, we go for the truth. But having gone through the 3-day training, I would say the word confession came up every 10 or 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. That's what they're going for.
Sure.
So wow. this is a real concern.
Yeah, it's that old thing about direct and circumstantial evidence. And how many times do you hear them on TV say it's a circumstantial case? And I would say, well, hallelujah. Because the direct evidence, of course, is a confession or an eyewitness, and they are notoriously wrong, where circumstantial evidence is all the science we've been talking about all the way back to Lacassagne. And it doesn't change its mind, you know.
No.
It's there, yeah.
And it doesn't mean all confessions are false, but the technique of making a confession your primary goal, as happens in some cases, is not a good one. And as you know, in the article, I cite some really upsetting cases of that.
Well, that's what I want to ask you. Can you talk to us about a case or two that where this method, these types of things, really screwed the pooch?
Yeah. I mean, I guess your listeners know about the case of the Central Park Five in New York. It was also called the jogger who was raped, and it was this case of Wilding back in the 80s. And
right.
The police induced five young men to confess, and DNA evidence showed they didn't do it. They spent many years in jail. Now they have a huge settlement. There was a young man named, I forgot his name, he lived in New York, in Long Island. And he came out of his bedroom and in the kitchen found both of his parents on the floor dying of multiple stab wounds. When the police showed up, it was Marty Tankleff, who was 17. When the police showed up, one of the cops looked at him and thought, this kid should be more upset. Didn't occur to the cop that maybe the kid was in shock. This kid should be more upset. And the cop was later quoted as saying, I knew it immediately that he was the guy. So they interrogated him for many hours using a technique similar to this. The other thing that I'd neglected to mention is American police are allowed to lie to you during an interrogation. And it was a Supreme Court case that gave them this right. In England, they're not. In Canada, they're not. So I could be talking to you as an interrogator and said, you know, we found your fingerprints on the gun. Or we could say, your friend told us he saw you do it. And there's a chance you'll break down. So what they did with Marty was, here's a kid, a teenager. His mother is dead. His father is dying. They told him that they found his hair under her fingernails, which meant he must have killed her, and that his father on the deathbed fingered him as the killer. So he went away to jail, ostensibly for life imprisonment, until many years later they found the real killers. This happened to a man in Troy, New York. His baby died, probably of a pneumocystis infection, but the police brought him in. And it's a marvelous, upsetting documentary called Scenes of a Crime, and it shows the case happening. And while the police were interrogating the man, the baby was brain dead, and they said, look, Adrian, we could save your baby if you just tell us exactly what you did to him. Kid was dead already. All we need is you to tell us what happened. And when that wasn't working, they said, by the way, your wife said you did it. Now, there were two adults there, so either you did it or your wife. So who's gonna fess up? And he spent 5 years in jail before he was set free. I saw a hour-and-a-half interrogation from a state in the Midwest where a young man was accused of fondling a three-year-old at the daycare center where he worked. There was no possibility he did that. He was never alone with the kid. And the detective, a perfect read technique, in a very gentle way, almost as if he was a counselor or a big brother to the kid, talked the kid into confessing. And what happens sometimes is they'll start bringing up the blackout thing. If they're just not getting anywhere, they'll say, well, maybe you blacked out. Maybe that happened. You know, sometimes you space out and you don't know what you're doing. Next thing you know, you've done something and you're horrified. And they actually talk the kid into confessing to this. And fortunately, the detective left. The boy's sister came in, and she said, you didn't do anything. He said, I know. He snapped out of it. But except for that, God knows what had happened to him. So it happens distressingly common.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's sort of a good cop, bad cop technique.
Yeah,
they come on soft and then come on hard, and you have the good guy and the bad guy, or at least maybe it's the same person even, but sometimes he's nice and sometimes he's not so nice.
Well,
it doesn't work so well. So what other methods are better?
So I also became trained in a method taught in England called the PEACE method, which isn't for peacefulness, but PEAC, your initials for steps in the technique. What happened in England is they had a bunch of terrible false conviction during the Irish Troubles. And in 1992, there were several cases of horrible cases where people were set free after they were coerced in confessing. So what the Brits did, ever practical, is they said, you know what, we should get some psychologists in here. By the way, when I was interviewing the Reed people, I said, since this thing was developed in the early 1950s, have you ever consulted with a psychologist? Never. Almost a point of pride. It's all based on practical experience. The Brits got a team of psychologists, attorneys, and police detectives who convened for 2 years to come up with a method that would get better information. And this technique is very different than the American technique. They're not allowed to fib or lie. You don't browbeat. You don't do the denial thing. It's almost like a journalistic interview. And I became trained in that technique as well, which means I'm one of maybe 6 people in the world who've been trained in both techniques, which was fascinating. And the British technique all involves asking open-ended questions. They prepare for hours for the interview. And the interesting thing is the psychological theory behind that is it's not stressful to lie. A lot of people are good at it. But it's a cognitive load, which means if I'm making up stories, I got a lot of facts to keep in the air. And eventually, I'm going to bobble them. So what they do is they'll do a long, open-ended interview, maybe go investigate it, maybe come back, and then they'll go back over the details. And what happens is if the person's lying, he can't keep the details straight. And I met with a British constable, and he showed me tapes of this, and it's uncanny. There was one guy who killed his wife, and in case after case, he eventually got the details wrong. At no time did they say, you killed your wife, don't deny it. No drama. It was all very low-key. They said, okay, well, Dave, you said you had mud, but the test showed it was blood. Can you explain that to me? Or, Dave, you said you were not in this village, but there's a parking ticket. Can you explain that to me? Always like that. The most intense it got was when the officer said, Dave, I'm really struggling with this. You must help me understand this. Why isn't this adding up? That's as intense as it got. And the guy was convicted of murder because every important factual detail fell apart. And they don't go for confessions. They go for information. So they've adopted it. New Zealand adopted it. One of the Scandinavian countries adopted it. Parts of Canada are, and people are talking about it here, but I don't know. It's fascinating.
Well, I like the term you use, cognitive load. I think that's a great term for that. As you know, they've done PET scans and they've done functional MRIs on people who are telling the truth and people who are making stuff up. And it requires a whole lot more brain power to make stuff up than it does just to recall something.
Yeah.
And this is actually visible on these scans in many circumstances. Obviously, it's ongoing research, and we don't know the answer yet. Everybody's looking for the perfect lie detector.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Of course, there is none. There's no perfect, but this is a very interesting thing. And you're right, it's the cognitive load, because you know people are good liars.
Yeah.
And the body language stuff is rubbish. I was watching the video of this guy who killed his wife. He was totally relaxed in his body language. He just couldn't keep his facts straight.
Yeah.
So that's what it's about.
Well, there are two things I think that I wish you know, jurors thought differently about. One is eyewitness accounts, and after reading your article, of course, jurors love confessions. I mean, that's I think a lot of times jurors go in with this kind of load on them, saying, you know, we have this pressure to find out what really happened when he confessed. Should jurors question confessions?
Yeah, they should. I mean, everybody should. The police should. The attorney should. The prosecutor should. The judges should. The jurors should. It's a very dicey thing. Nobody has a proportion of which ones are good and which aren't. I had written also about eyewitness identification, and it's the same notion that we imagine memory is a videotape, and it's not. What it is it's a big piece of china that you dropped on the floor, and how do we put the pieces together? And when you're questioning somebody to put the pieces together, if you start contaminating that stuff, if somebody said, I think it was that guy in the lineup, and you said, great, you picked the right one, you just contaminated that person's memory, because now the person is sure it's the right one. So all of this stuff has to be questioned. you know,
a great analogy.
It has to be examined from the scientific point of view, from the jury's point of view. I think sometimes jurors get a little overwhelmed by the scientific back and forth, and I've seen jurors say things like, well, he just looked guilty. And I can understand the frustration, but you really can't be doing that.
Well, I know how these interrogation techniques and a lot of other things, almost anything you can think of, get entrenched in systems. And people, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years, don't tell me how to do my job, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And besides all the human toll on this, the wrongful confessions, wrongful convictions, time in jail, et cetera, are there costs and liabilities to departments that don't recognize the fallacy of this and other techniques that that are disproven or poo-pooed, and are they on the hook potentially?
You know, they tend to get off the hook. It's very rare that a prosecutor is in trouble, you know, unless they've really violated the part of the law that said, the rule of evidence that said you have to show exculpatory evidence to the defense attorney. What it's important to remember, though, is that neither the police, nor the prosecutors, nor the American citizens want guilty people running free. So it's important to remember that for every innocent person that's put in jail, the real guy is on the loose.
Right.
And perhaps hurting other people. So this is the hook, and none of these people want this to happen. You know, Jan had emphasized earlier that we're talking about people who want to do a good job, and that's been my impression as well. Some of the most egregious cases you see, it's people say, well, we really thought we had the guy. So I think it's a matter of training. And something that I've been writing about lately is sort of backing up and taking a whole systems look at this. You know, when an airplane crashes, people don't say, oh, that pilot was such a bad person. They do this kind of analysis of what were the factors that led to this. And what a number of people are beginning to do is say, can we do that in the law? You know, we've got this terrible case in Ferguson, and I was talking to one of the legal analysts, and he said, you know, that police officer didn't wake up and say, I want to shoot somebody today. And he said, that kid didn't wake up and say, I want to attack a cop today and get shot. He said, so how could things have been set up to avoid such a tragic outcome? What if the cop had other weapons at his disposal, not just pepper and a gun? What if there was more precise training about what to do in situations like this? Do you follow or don't you? What if in certain neighborhoods they had two people in the car? He said, is it possible to begin to look at our legal structures in a fault-free way, at least temporarily, like when we're looking at an airplane crash, to try to be more intelligent about that? That's a hard thing, because where we are in history right now is all the voices we hear are screaming voices, which is why it's so nice to hear a show called Crime and Science,
right.
Crime and Rage. That's right. Let's be thinking about it.
Well, we hope we're doing our part here. Well,
yeah.
Just sort of to go off on that a bit, do you have any concerns about the current state of science journalism?
Well, not the way we teach it in our program, but I do. I do in general. And that is the science stories are very difficult to portray in the simplistic either-or fashion that you see in the media. So something like climate change, which is really kind of scientifically there, but many of the traditional journalists still feel it's necessary to say, well, on the one side and on the other side. But not everything has two sides. Or sometimes two sides aren't equal. Maybe one side is really the scientific consensus, and the other side is a fringe group that insists on shouting about it. Okay, but let's put it in perspective. Or with some of these vaccine discussions where people don't want to get vaccinated because despite all of the epidemiological studies, they still believe that the vaccine is giving their child autism, to pick an explosive case. And again, there's this problem of some of the journalists aren't too good at teasing apart the arguments and saying, look, here are the arguments, but here's really the scientific consensus. or in the constant stories you see about dieting. So, I think it's a problem, which is why we have this graduate program, so that the people who come out of it really see things in depth and context. It's hard. It's hard stuff.
Sometimes I really think that statistics should be required.
Yeah.
Yep.
But just everybody. People just often don't understand what the numbers mean. Well, it's sort of on this line. Forensic scientists that talk to me often say reporters never get it right. Which is one of the few times you'll ever hear a forensic scientist use the word never. But what they really mean is that they're often talking to people who have little or no understanding of science and who, because of that, misrepresent what they're told in interviews. And they talk to it turns out that the journalists are looking for somebody who can give them a good copy, and so they're talking to what we could politely, the politest term I can come up with for them are the publicity hounds of forensic science. There are those people in forensic science who kind of seem really ready to talk to the reporters, but who are not always the best sources. So what can be done about those problems?
There are two sizes, so there's the journalist and there's the scientist. And I do hear from scientists, and they always say, and oftentimes I and my colleagues and students have this speed bump to get over where there's the obligatory of, well, most of the journalists I talk to don't get it, and why should I talk to you? And, you just sort of have to be patient. I think the scientists need to know that all journalists are not alike, not all people are alike, and that they are allowed to pick and choose. And if somebody calls them who's clearly is going to distort what they have to say, they can hang up the phone. They don't have to take every call. So that's important. It's also important to know that a journalist could disagree with you but still have integrity. And I've had a number of scientists after the fact say, I really don't like what you said, and there'll be a pause, but I respect what you did. So that's important. Mm-hmm. My colleagues and I are not out to be loved. We're out to be respected and to do a good job. From the journalist's point of view, I think it behooves any science journalist to get the training. You wouldn't ask a football writer to write about football who had never seen a game before. You'd expect that person to be a real expert on football. So we expect our graduate students to be thoroughly versed in science and really understand the scientific method and really know p-values and some statistics so they could really begin to ask the right questions. And also you could begin to weed out the media heroes. And I often find that I don't love to interview the people who get all the publicity, even if they know this stuff, because there's this sort of glossy surface that you could never get below. And all you get is the sound bites. And the other thing is I make it clear to them is I'm not on the phone or not in person to get quotes. I'm here to get an understanding of the subject. And I tell my students that. Don't worry so much about the quotes. You'll get them. First, learn what the person is talking about. And I find if you establish that kind of relationship, it works better for everybody.
Well, you mentioned the vaccine thing. I haven't seen a case of the whooping cough since I was a junior medical student, which was many, many, many years ago. And we had a one-man outbreak here in Orange County of about 30 cases of whooping cough that were all traced back to one pediatrician because he thought vaccines caused autism. So go figure. It's everywhere. My patients always bring me stuff. Like I found this on the internet. And my response is always, I don't want to see it. Any moron with a modem can put anything they want on the internet. So how does the average person who is looking for this type of information in the scientific world or whatever, how do they know what's real and what's imagined when they read a newspaper or find something online? What would you advise
them? Great question, because with the internet, everybody could find whatever truth they feel like.
Right.
And people almost think that, because it's in the internet, it used to be, well, it was in the LA Times or it was in the newspaper. It's on the internet. Well, the internet is everybody. It's like saying it's in the air. So I think it should be a knee-jerk response to check the source. Where did this come from? Is this from some kind of fringe website? Is this from a trusted source? I mean, if you're looking at medical information, the Mayo Clinic has a wonderful website about real medical stuff on the Internet, and many of the medical schools do. So I think there's an additional check that used to take place. It used to be that because there were only three major networks, if we saw Walter Cronkite or Peter Jennings say something, chances are it was pretty close to being true because there was a filtering mechanism that the thing had to be relevant and kind of true to make it all the way there. Now that there are a million networks by the Internet, anything could be anything. So news consumers now have to do this additional gut check of, well, where did I exactly read that? And what's this person's track record? And what's their agenda? So it just means more homework for all of us.
Yeah, they got to build their own filter.
What?
You know, I would love to talk to you again, but so really quickly before we wind up here, tell us what's up next from Douglas Starr. What are you working on now?
I am still fascinated by this dysfunctional relationship between science and the law and the innocent people that fall in there. So actually this week, if this is in January, it's out now. There's an online magazine called Aeon, A-E-O-N, that I actually did a fairly big essay on this whole question of the culture of science versus the culture of law and what could be righted about that. And I'm still looking into this whole area of science and justice. I'm finding it fascinating.
Very good.
Well, we're so glad you are working on that, and we hope we'll get to talk to you again sometime. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, everyone, and you can read more about Doug and his work on our website, crimeandscienceradio.com.